Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 4th. Today's session is entitled Listening to the Groaning of Creation, Romans 8, presented by Barbara Rossing, session number ROB 2006-05. Let's listen in.
Snowman out there. I can't believe somebody brought back that snow. Great. So the end is near, and indeed this is the last day of our class. Oh, I should say roll the paper, circling the seat. And this is the last day of our class looking at the whole issue of ecology as a lens for reading the New Testament and looking at how we can use the Bible to respond to our environmental crisis, which I believe is a dire and very, very important crisis that the church and the world have to face. So today, the passage I want to look at with you is Romans chapter 8. And again, I know we've been jumping in the middle of books throughout the week here. Yesterday, we jumped into the end of the book of Job, and you had to summarize 37 chapters for me before we can contextualize. Yes, you did an excellent job. So we need to do the same with Romans here a little bit. Let me just say, I think Paul's letters are really wonderful and really important. And the book of Romans was his last letter and a kind of culmination of his own thinking. So even though this, like all his letters, is what we would call an occasional letter. That is, it's occasioned by something. It's not a systematic theology book. It's a letter to a community. So he treats topics that that are not in a systematic way. Nevertheless, this letter in some ways sums up his theology, and it was his final one before he was killed. And it's just a wonderful letter. I teach a little class, I think about up here holding, reading Romans through the back door. Picking up on Rick Steves' idea of, you know, Europe through the back door, where I start at the end of the book of Romans and look at the chapter 16 with all his greetings to various people, all these people that he names, at least a third of which are women. Then reading back through Romans 15, his wonderful emphasis on koinonia and community that I also want to talk about today. In the middle of the letter, just before his long section on dealing with what's the relationship between Jews and Christians, Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians that we see in chapters 9 through 11, you get this wonderful chapter 8 about the Spirit, and in the middle of that is this interesting passage about creation. He suddenly introduces another word that we haven't dealt with in this class so far. This is the word creation, or ktisis is the Greek word. I talked the first couple days about several words that the book of Revelation uses, gay being the earth, cosmos being another word for world, oikoumene being a word for inhabited world that I think also comes to mean the imperial world. But ktisis is another word that we need to look at in the New Testament in trying to retrieve or pull out in the ecological theology. And here, Paul doesn't use it very much. The only other places he uses it are in the letter to the Galatians and 2 Corinthians, where he talks about if anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation.
What is this word? You didn't write it up.
No, I will. Okay. It's the word creation.
Yeah, but in Greek.
Okay.
Thank you.
K-T-I-S-I-S. And then the verb is ktizo, I create. But he doesn't use it very much, and we think in those passages, at least in Galatians, when he talks about a person being a new creation, he's talking about baptism. 2 Corinthians, you know, that one, it might be more also about the creation. But here, clearly in Romans, it is about the creation, and it's a very intriguing passage. So maybe we should start by reading it. This is the passage from which Leonardo Boff gets that idea of the two parallel cries that he hears in the Bible, the cry of the poor, that is so strong and has been the predominant focus of liberation theology, but also the cry of creation, the cry of the earth. And Bob says we need to bring these together, and I think Paul is certainly one who does that. Let's start with verse 18.
I'll do it. Okay. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. The creation waits in eager expectation sons of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons and the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. But hope is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what he already has? But if we hope for what we do not yet have, we wait for it patiently. In the same way, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groans that words cannot express. And he who searches our hearts knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints in accordance with God's will.
Okay, let's stop there. Well, there's a lot of words to look at in here, but I wanted to start with this word in the first verse, kairos, where Paul says, I consider the sufferings of this present time, that's the Greek word kairos, are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. As I talked about on the first day, well, maybe we should show the slides now, Lauren, if that's okay. Paul and everybody writing in the New Testament are living in the context of the Roman Empire, and more New Testament scholars are thinking this is a very important backdrop for understanding what New Testament writings are about. So one possible hypothesis, and this is proposed by a number of people, including, this is one of my favorite books here, Klaus Fink's Pax Romana and the Peace of Jesus Christ. Unfortunately, it's out of print, but you can maybe get it secondhand, and I highly recommend it. But he thinks in this chapter that Paul is referring much more to the sufferings of empire and imperial injustice than we've taken that. Now, I mean, that's not in any way to say that this passage doesn't speak to you in your heart when you're going through sufferings. It certainly does. I mean, hopefully you love Romans 8, and, you know, we read it when visiting people in the hospital. It's one of the possible texts that's in the Compline service. I mean, Romans 8 about your sufferings is a great, great passage. But a number of New Testament scholars suggest that what Paul might have in mind here is not just sort of our personal or existential sufferings, but indeed persecutions of the empire and its oppression. So I wanted to show again some of those slides that I showed on Tuesday. We'll go through them faster today, just so you can see Rome's own imperial ideology once again. Because Klaus Banks argues that that's a very important backdrop for understanding the New Testament. And many other commentators also would say, for example, at the end of the chapter here, this is what you read at the hospital bed of someone who's suffering. But Banks argues, and a guy named Robert Jewett also, who teaches in Chicago and has just written the huge sort of Cadillac commentary on Paul's letter to the Romans in the Hermeneus series, this big one from Fortress Press. They always cost like $90. Very, very fancy. But it is the benchmark commentary series in English. Robert Jewett also suggests that when Paul does this catalog of hardships at the end of the chapter, I'm sure that neither death nor life nor angels nor principalities nor things present nor things to come nor powers nor heights nor depths nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. That he's speaking out of personal experience of suffering at the hands of the empire, that he's got in mind the imperial suffering. So let's just look at a few of these pictures of empire, so you'll have that in your head as sort of possible backdrop to asking, what is Paul talking about then with the groaning of creation? How do you experience the groans of this and the sufferings of this present kairos? And how might this perspective that Paul brings to creation and to the sufferings of this present time help us as we deal with the ecological crisis? Uh-oh. All right, I'm not going to tell you who all these people are, but some of you saw it already on Tuesday.
But this is this this is what a lot of scholars think is sort of the now isn't something missing over
here? Yeah, yes. To the right.
The C.
It ratchets down.
Yeah,
a
the C
bit.
Is missing. I can't make the screen go over, so can you move the projector and help you?
That's a sweet way of saying
it. It's all there.
Okay. It is? The C is there too? No. Okay. All right. How about click on the big one then with everything?
Okay.
Oh, dear.
I got to slide it over.
But we can have the bottom as well, all at once.
Oh, there
you go.
Okay, okay. This is this big cameo called the Gemma Augustea, carved in sardonyx, that is sort of an embodiment of Roman imperial ideology in this magnificent, exquisite form. Over here at the left, Nike, the winged figure of victory, is driving the chariot. Seated on the throne here is Augustus. Can you do with the bottom panel too, Lauren? Emperor Augustus sitting next to Roma. So we can get the barbarians down here, the captives. There, okay, great. And then can you make it full screen? Sorry, this is my IT department, it's really wonderful. Okay, so, I need my pool cue again.
There you go.
Okay. Augustus sitting next to Roma. So the Roman Empire is a divine power that is propping up Augustus. Then he's being crowned by Oikoumene, the whole inhabited world. And earth and ocean are also paying homage to him. And the thing that's striking here is the whole thing rests on this ideology of conquest. The captive nations whose conquest, celebrated by Nike, by victory here, is embodied in these enslaved figures being pulled by their hair, and the Roman soldiers here are putting up this trophy. But the picture clearly shows that Rome's victory rests not on an easy kind of peace, but on the peace that is conquest, and on the backs of all these captives here. Okay, what else? Here's the bottom one. Okay, just a few coins here that show this ideology of victory. The globe, first of all, in all these you see Caesar Divi, the divine Caesar. The globe starts to make an appearance. They did know the world was round, but they weren't interested in it for its own sake, but rather for the sake of this ideology of conquest. That Caesar, divine Caesar, stands on the orb of the globe, conquers the whole world. And this is that winged figure of Nike again, the victory figure. That I think when victory is mentioned in the New Testament, it's as a counter-ideology to Rome's theology of conquering. Okay. And here's this one of Augustus standing with his foot on the globe, clearly having triumphed over the whole world. Okay, now these next pictures are from, and I've added a couple new ones for those of you who already saw them on Tuesday, from this amazing building not too far from Ephesus in Asia Minor, called a city called Aphrodisias, that had these great marble quarries. And so as a consequence, this whole sculpture industry really started up. But they found this amazing set of panels that were the colonnade leading up to an imperial temple in the mid-first century, or let's say probably in the 60s or 70s of the first century. So after Paul's letters, but not that much after Paul's letters, and before the book of Revelation, but all in the first century, showing this ideology of conquest. And this is a picture of Emperor Claudius subduing Great Britain. Britannia as this personified feminine figure here, and he's pulling her hair. And then the next one is Nero subjugating Armenia. This is how they embodied this ideology of conquest and ruling. And then this is Claudius again, so I found this one that I was looking for. This is Earth offering the cornucopia to Claudius. So even though some of it is eroded, you can see she's giving him a cornucopia, symbolizing the earth is turning over its fruits to Claudius. And then this is Ocean giving the rudder. So Claudius, in his two arms, has basically conquered land on the one hand and sea on the other hand. And this is this ideology of Rome having completely conquered the whole Oikoumene, or the whole world. And that then they claimed this would last forever. It was Roma Eterna. But Paul, I think, is saying, hey, this present time, this present Kairos, is a time not of jubilant celebration. I mean, he was right around the time of Claudius.
And he's countering this sort of the ideology of Claudius saying all is well, we've got peace, we've got security, we've got victory, earth and creation have offered up themselves to me. I think Paul says, no, this present time is one of suffering. It's a kairos that's going to come to an end. We're waiting for the liberation of the world from this ideology. Here's another panel from the same building. This is Emperor Augustus being crowned by Nike here. Or can you see the wings on her?
Yep.
Yeah. This is her wing. Okay, so this is Nike. Again, this is that winged figure of victory. And they're setting up together a trophy. But look what the trophy is sitting on. Again, it's the captives. They like to embody in their propaganda that Roman conquest rests on the subjugation of captive nations and captive peoples. And they advertise this fact. This is Roman imperial propaganda. Okay, well, is that it? Okay. But this is kind of the classic. Thanks so much. So, given that then, as a picture of what was going on in Paul's time, it sort of broadens, I think, how we understand the sufferings of the present Kairos. Whoops. I'll have to deal with that later. Actually, I'll pull it down later because I'm going to show you at the end, if you want, if people want to stay later, I'll show you this 60 Minutes thing that had Tim Lay and Gary Jenkins and me on it and from 2 years ago. Now that the bookstore got my book in. Would somebody be willing to turn the lights on? Okay, so as you read this text in Romans 8, let me just say a couple other words that are so prominent here. The word waiting comes up three times. That this clear sense that the present time, the present Kairos, isn't going to last forever, but we're waiting for liberation, Paul says. We are waiting and creation is waiting. So you've got this word waiting in verse 19. For the creation waits with eager longing. You've got it in verse 23. Not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan as we wait for adoption as sons and daughters. And then verse 25. If we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. So this sense of waiting for a future. And I think this can help us now as we face a kind of end times in our way of life. We talked about those first days of how do you juxtapose. You can't just go with this kind of business as usual sense that all is well with our American way of life, with empire, with our consumption of oil, with our current patterns. There is a sense right now of something coming to a kind of end. And I read that Peggy Noonan quote where she talks about the wheels are falling off the trolley is off the tracks. And you've certainly got that in Romans. Maybe diagnosing things differently, but the sense of waiting for a different something of which Christ is the first fruits. His death and resurrection are the first fruits or down payment on this, but we're definitely waiting and groaning and longing for some kind of future hope. So maybe we can start by asking, where do you hear the groanings of creation in your own context? And then I want to end with, what do we do about it? I mean, how does the gospel envision a way of life that's different? The groanings of creation, Paul talks about it as birth pangs in verse 22. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in travail. That's this word that has the sense of groaning to give birth, and not only the creation, but we ourselves. So I think it's helpful to ask, what are the sufferings of this present time that you experience ecologically or otherwise in your communities? Where do you hear the groanings of creation? I should say, I was just reading last night in the latest Sierra Club magazine something that I didn't know anything about, which is these coal-fired power plants in Chicago that are from the 1950s that have not ever been cleaned up and are estimated to cause, I can't believe it, that this Fisk coal-fired power plant in the Pilsen neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, not that far from where we live, and eight other coal-fired plants together caused 300 deaths per year and 14,000 asthma attacks, according to a 2000 study by a team of Harvard researchers. So I've talked most of all this week about global warming, but I think there's a lot of other ways we feel and our communities feel the groaning of creation as well that we need to respond to, that God is crying out to us. Uh-huh.
I think even, you know, a lot of people will say if creation didn't have humans, then it would be perfect and fine. But having undergraduate in biology, I mean, just the very nature of creation itself with the death and the struggle that goes on within creation, it's not perfect by any stretch. And I just see it itself groaning within itself and, you know, short life and often brutal.
Now, that's an interesting question, though, that sometimes biologists take on theologians with this whole, and actually a guy at Fort Collins, what is his name? He won a huge Templeton Prize, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Oh man, I can't think of his name. He's an environmental writer. He has an article called, "Does Nature Need to Be Redeemed?" Because, of course, it does sound like Paul is suggesting that the whole creation is groaning, waiting for redemption. But some scientists will ask, hey, it's only because of human sin that nature does need to be redeemed. Would nature, if it were some pristine, you know, left alone without us, need redemption? And it's an interesting sort of philosophical, theological question. I mean, is death in nature something that needs to come to an end, or how would you describe it? It's a hard one to get your mind around, and there's people on both sides of the debate, but it sounds like you're saying you would say that nature needs redemption.
I hear the prophets when they talk about lions eating grass, and it sounds like there's a different image of creation before and after, and that a new creation sounds rather vegetarian. And but there, you know, we were walking with the kids and we saw the three bear cubs. And I mean, you know, Dad always throws a bucket of cold water, but I said, you know, only one of those bear cubs is probably going to survive the winter just because.
Oh, Dad.
Did you have to say that? It's so cute. But, it is brutal.
But you're longing for a redeemed nature where that wouldn't be the case, where all three, uh-huh.
Right.
But if everything, nothing dies and everything lives, the animals will, there'll be too many animals. What happened to the dinosaurs? Humans weren't involved in that.
Yeah, this is the debate. So I don't want to mainly focus on this, but it is a very interesting debate of asking, I mean, and what we have to get down to then is what has subjected the creation. Paul's saying the whole creation is groaning, but why is it? It's because creation was subjected, in verse 20, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope. What on earth does Paul mean there? So he clearly thinks that creation is in bondage to something, but what is it, and who caused it, and what's the answer to it?
I don't see that. I mean, nature doesn't need us. We need nature. Mm-hmm. I mean, nature will be just fine if we're not here. I mean, it'll go along, it'll renew itself. You see that in rivers that were polluted, and they just stopped all the pollution and let it go, and then remarkably the river made itself back. Right. In a number of years. So, in my eyes, nature doesn't need to be redeemed. We need to be redeemed from ourselves and let nature do its thing. I think it's, you know, we're putting ourselves in the front here, and it should be the other way around.
Right. Well, maybe I should just say, because I don't want to get just, I mean, we can do that philosophical debate if you want to talk about that one for a few more minutes. It's fine. I've been in it numerous times. And it's a really important one, too. But I think what's interesting to note here is Paul seems to not think of a pristine natural world either. I mean, he apparently, Robert Jewett suggests, let me just read this quote from Jewett, that when Paul says the whole creation has been groaning for liberation, early Christian audiences, quote, could well have thought about how imperial ambitions, military conflicts, and economic exploitation had led to the erosion of the natural environment throughout the Mediterranean world, leaving ruined cities, depleted fields, deforested mountains, and polluted streams. So maybe what he's focusing on is not so much nature in its pristine state, but the way that, in fact, people were experiencing deforestation and silting of rivers. I mean, we know, for example, in Ephesus, that harbor is now 2-3 miles further out than it used to be, and they were chronically struggling with problems of siltation because they were cutting down the forests upstream. We know in the Mediterranean world, Turkey, it, where Ephesus is, and the rest of the Mediterranean world, used to have the cedars of Lebanon everywhere, and now don't. So it might be that the sort of hypothetical question about nature without us isn't in the Bible's mind at all, but it's rather how we have subjected creation, and that it's part of Adam and Eve's sin. I mean, most scholars will say this probably harkens back to the Genesis curse idea, that a consequence of Adam and Eve's fall is not only that they are expelled from the garden and the curse is there, but that nature also is subjected in a way that it's not able to free itself, even if what it's subjected to is us. That might be what Paul is speaking to. Uh-huh.
Part of this analogy bothers me as we characterize ourselves as victims. And in a way, I think we are now the empire. And so if Paul was complaining that the Romans were messing the world up, we shouldn't identify with those victims. We should identify with the Romans who messed the world up. And this business of waiting, groaning and waiting, leaves out the word choice. It makes us feel as though we have nothing to say about this. It's happening to us like a weather pattern. And whereas, in fact, we did this ourselves. This is all done by human choice, every single bit of it. And I bristle when I hear we're waiting for Jesus to heal us or God to zap us back into harmony again. We need to do it ourselves.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I don't think it's necessarily an either or, though. I mean, I think the groaning of creation can easily be something that we hear is something to respond to. I don't think it's just a passive sort of waiting here. I think he's calling forth a response, or that can be it. But that's a really important point. A couple other hands back here.
Oh, you know, I was just thinking how it's interesting to hear how we consider, you know, there's nature and then there's us, when in fact we're all nature. And maybe if we could get over some of that dualistic idea, we would just naturally take better care of our environment, because we are nature as well. I mean, we're all nature.
And that's one of the questions in this text, is when Paul says creation, does he include humans or not? And I think he is, that when he says katisis, the creation, he means, just as you say, it's both we and nature. But that's a big question. A further one that you can ask is when he says in verse 24, for in this hope we were saved, does he view that nature, the creation, I'll use that word since that's what he's using, has also been saved, or is the we just people? And I think we have to go back and ask big questions like that, too. It's not necessarily what we were taught in catechism class, you know, because my confirmation pastor very definitely told me animals don't go to heaven, you know, just people. But is that, you know, and he shocked us all, you know, thinking about our cats and dogs and stuff. But, you know, is Paul saying that here when he talks about salvation, for in this hope we were saved? Or does he think in some way that all of creation is saved? Is it an anthropomorphic view of salvation, or does it encompass creation more? And these are big questions. I mean, scholars debate these, so feel free to join in. What does he mean by salvation? Now, I'll just read this quote from my colleague David Rhodes, who's been a leader. He's a New Testament scholar. I can't believe we're all at LSTC together working on this stuff, but it's so wonderful. He's written, you know, cutting-edge works on the Gospel of Mark. He also manages this Web of Creation website that we've got, where we have the National Council of Churches, Eco-Justice Work Group, all kinds of web pages. He's very much an environmentalist. And he wrote this little article that I wish had been published in a less obscure place, because it's so wonderful. It's called Who Will Speak for the Sparrow? Eco-Justice Criticism of the New Testament, where he says we really need to move in a much more ecological direction interpreting the New Testament. But he makes this claim here. We have failed to see the assumptions of early Christians that all life is communal, that all human communities are embedded in the natural world. Thus, in the New Testament, there is no salvation apart from community, and there is no community apart from the whole creation. So he would definitely argue that when Paul and others talk about salvation, that it's Jesus died not just for humans, but Jesus died for the whole creation.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big reader of C.S. Lewis and Chronicles of Narnia, and I think that would support that.
Oh, yeah, animals are being, yeah, they're talking, yes.
Right, but I think his theological framework would fit with what you just said that David wrote.
Yeah, and let me just say, this is the complete opposite of the Left Behind novels and the theology they're teaching. They teach, Hal Lindsey has this passage that I use, that at the last moment, you know, before the world careens off into World War III and destruction that's going to kill 3/4 of the population, they believe in this so-called rapture that's going to snatch Christians up to heaven. But clearly they think the rapture is for people only, not for any part of creation. I mean, the whole creation, in their view, is going to be destroyed. That's God's plan. But people, born-again Christians, get saved out of their beds for 7 years and get to watch it all. I mean, I don't think that's what Paul is talking about here. In my view, the creation and salvation are not confined to just being people on the one hand that are saved, or that creation doesn't mean us.
I would agree. I think people are a part of creation, and we cannot separate that. I think that I observed close up a little bit more creation groaning when we lived on the San Juan Islands. And on one of the islands was the garbage dump, and it wasn't hidden away. And when you drove by that, it was staggering.
On the San Juan Island?
Yes.
That's not how we think of the San Juan.
No. And on one of the islands, there's this huge garbage dump. And it's appalling that you're driving through these beautiful islands and you see this dump. And you drive away from that, and it's sort of hideous, and you want it hidden away. But it's there. And who created it? All of us. Well, maybe not. I lived there, so I was a part of the dump. And you can be shocked by that, but do I quit throwing away garbage? Do I quit creating it? When I go down the lake, I'm going to get in my car and drive home. I'm a part of the problem. And so I think we groan and we wait. We try to do what we can. But in some ways, we're still a part of the problem. And I think that's the tension. Because we are a part of creation, but we are also sinful people.
And I think Paul is saying here that it's our sin that subjected creation. I mean, God is probably the one who subjected creation, the one who subjected it in hope. But it's certainly part of the Adam and Eve thing. I mean, yes, it's definitely tied to us. I was just going to say that your thing about the garbage, I didn't know about that on San Juan Islands. I'm shocked. But we start this course that I teach on Bible and ecology. We start out the first week reading a book called Garbage Wars, about the history of waste dumping and garbage in Chicago, and it's not a pretty history. And then we take the students on what's called a toxic tour of the South Side of Chicago, sponsored by this organization, the Southeast Environmental Task Force, where we go and see these huge landfills. I mean, Chicago is flat. We have no hills, right? Except for the garbage mounds, the landfills. It's these giant hills. I mean, you could ski jump off them or something. And this is the history of garbage in Chicago. And every community has it. I mean, it's not a good story. Moreover, they're in communities of color, largely. And you know, this whole issue of environmental racism, we really need to be thinking about linking, you know, environmentalism not just to aging white tree huggers and our love for the glaciers, but to communities in urban settings that are really suffering as a result of racist ecological decisions, and that all of us are tied together as part of the growing of creation. That toxic tour was quite an eye-opener.
Right there by the door.
Uh-huh.
Just to bring it back to the idea of empire, and I just kind of wonder, two comments. One, that the minute we start thinking of ourselves as alien from nature, I think that leads us down a path that's just incredibly detached from reality. But this idea of, you know, come back to the garbage dump, and part of empire is our joining that, because that's the easiest path. I'm just wondering if Paul isn't trying to remind us that, you know, empire is what's causing the suffering. How do we stand up then against that as a people, as a part of it? And I'm just wondering,
especially if it's us, as this gentleman said.
Oh, I mean, right. How do you change? How do you not jump in your car the minute you need to go somewhere?
All right, let's go to that question since it is the last day here. Because I think that is a key question. And I mean, in the book of Revelation, what that answer is, you have to come out of empire. Revelation 18, verse 6, come out of it, my people, lest you share in its plagues, lest you share in its sins. Now, Paul doesn't say that, but I think all the New Testament authors are talking about this. How do we come out of participation in this unjust way of life as we wait for the redemption and liberation that has already been given to us in Jesus Christ? What does it look like? Let me say a couple things about this passage, but then I really want to open it up. I mean, how do we do it? That's why you're in Holden here, hopefully, is to get ideas for how you're going to live and how we all can live. One thing that strikes me in this passage is the emphasis on solidarity, and it's the Greek preposition syn, which means together. Paul sticks this, he can make up words. He loves to make up words. So actually, one of these words, it's the one that's translated eager longing in verse 19, he made that up, apokaradokia. He uses it also in Philippians to talk about himself. He's got eager longing. Here he says creation is eager longing. Well, he made that word up, but it's a wonderful word. But another thing he does when he's making up words is to stick this prefix together on the front of a lot of verbs, which I think is helpful for us to see this incredible sense of solidarity that flows through this whole passage. So he does it on groaning, for example. Verse 22, creation groans together, travails together. He does it with suffering together. He does it with waiting together, with hoping together. I think he really sees us and creation in solidarity and also us in solidarity with one another. And that's a key way that he says that we can address the question you're talking about. You cannot do it alone. This is one of the key reasons I tell my students, you've got to learn Greek so you can hear the difference between you and you in the Bible, that it's mostly plural. The you in the Bible overwhelmingly is you together or you all. It's not a singular kind of you. You can't do it together. There's solidarity that just flows through this passage as we wait for the full revelation. But in the meantime, you live in communities that live differently, that try to not participate in perpetuating these injustices. Uh-huh.
It was a wonderful example of that is, and I had such a new sense of creation, of God's creation, on a photo safari that I was recently on. And Jimmy, our guide, was showing us, and we were all kind of, ooh, there's a pile of water buffalo dung. And he said, you know, as humans, we've gotten so afraid of this. And he's kicking around it, and he said, this is beautiful. Mm-hmm. He said, in a bit, another water buffalo is going to come up to this and say, ah, it's Dolores. For a long time. She's healthy. She's good. I know where she's going, and I'm going to go find her, and it's time we strike up a relationship.
Well, I thought you were going to say she's going to eat the poop, because that's something.
No, don't do that. But it's that sense of the creation being so together in a beautiful way, and it was beautiful. And all this from a pile of dung that we're all trying to avoid, and he's in there kicking it and showing us a whole new sense of God's creation that was just awesome.
Well, and I should say you all have the opportunity for that at Holden, not with dung, but with garbage. If you want to participate in one of the most fascinating areas of Holden that Tom Brackett swears is his favorite aspect, it's do garbology. It is an eye-opener when you're, you know, like sorting through trash and it all gets into, you know, the compost in various forms. It's quite fascinating. But it's certainly that idea of togetherness. I should say we also should bring in the spirit here. That's the anchor of the whole chapter at the beginning and the end, and that the sense of hope that runs through here is because the Spirit also intercedes for us, God's Spirit. But one thing that's wonderful to note is that creation groans in verse 22, we groan in verse 23, and then the Spirit groans in verse 26. It's the same word used for all of them. So this, even the Spirit is in solidarity with us. But yeah, that connectedness, I think, is what's going to help us most. Uh-huh.
Another part of our action is the revealing of the children of God. And if you look above them,
and that's the word apocalypse, the apocalypse of the children of God. I mean, you guys, we are in our culture, we think of apocalypse as being, you know, catastrophe. Paul uses the word apocalypse a lot, and he simply means revelation or revealing. Uh-huh.
So, and above that, you know, becoming the children of God or being adopted as children of God is a place of boldness to go against what is already. So the revealing of the children of God is really casting off, you know, these mantles of denial and being revealed as ones who redeem the creation, as God is redeeming the creation, partners in that. I mean, I see that as a real, you know, claiming your identity, claiming your calling.
We may need to redeem ourselves.
And being active in that.
Thanks.
It's not as a passive waiting, but as a, but the creation is waiting for us to step up.
Yeah.
Be who we're called to be.
And needs us.
Yeah, go ahead.
And it's part of the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we are.
Are stepping up? Or
yeah, I do. I mean, how many people recycle today? Never heard about it before. You know, and I view the oil crisis as a plus. It's going to force us to use alternative fuel, force us to use smaller cars, other kinds of energy.
And less plastic.
Yeah, I just think it's, I think a positive thing is happening with this. I think we are aware.
Well, good for you. Okay. See, I thank you for that. I definitely believe we have to have hope. But I go more with the hope is the assurance of something not seen. I don't really see it yet like you see it, even though I hope for it. So that's great. You're telling us where you see it. Good for you. I mean, the word hope, it runs through this passage. 5 times hope is used. You cannot, as a Christian, not approach the future with hope. But you don't always see it, but it sounds like you do. Great.
Well, we're from Oregon.
I'd like to ask what the relationship is between what Paul's talking about and what happens after Noah comes out of the ark and he offers the offering and the Lord smells the odor and says in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of humankind. For the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth, nor will I ever again destroy every living creature as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease.
Isn't that a wonderful covenant?
And it seems like, I mean, what I'm taking from that is, I am not going to destroy you again because of your acts. You sort of don't get it, guys, but I'm going to hang in there with you. And you're going to figure it out, but I will not come in again and blitz everything. We're just going to work it together. I mean, it seems really hopeful to me. How does that work with what we're talking about here?
I think it does. I mean, absolutely, Paul would agree with that, and I think we really need to hear that. The problem is, I'll just say parenthetically, the authors of Left Behind say, in that passage, God is only promising, never again will I destroy the earth by water, but I can still use fire. Read again that verse where God says never again.
I will never again curse the ground because of humankind.
Or how about the destroy?
For the inclination of the human heart is evil from you, nor will I ever again destroy every living creature as I've done.
As I've done. They say that's only water, but God's got it out with fire. And they point to a very difficult verse in 2 Peter where they say that God says, I'm going to burn up the whole earth there. But that's not a good translation. I mean, we really work on that translation. It's a very difficult passage. But so in their mind, God is planning to destroy the whole creation, and it's part of the plan. I would agree with you. I don't think we can ever say that it is. But it doesn't mean that the consequences of actions aren't going to happen. I mean, so that's where I see the plagues of Revelation much more. I think I talked about that the second day too, in that sense of axiomatic. I mean, I'm not sure that this promise in Genesis that God makes, that wonderful promise after the flood, means that if we completely melt the glaciers, sea level's not going to rise. I mean, I don't know that God is going to intervene at that point. But so.
No, I don't either, because he does say we are evil. And we are going to do some things that, unless
God
fix them, I mean,
God
are going to be
bad. God made a promise that he would not destroy
but
the
he
earth.
Would.
But did people make the promise that we wouldn't?
Yeah, I think
you know,
that's
we
the
were
point.
Keeping up our side of the bargain.
Yeah, that's, I think that's in this verse.
Uh-huh.
Because he does say, for the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth. So we probably are going to be problematic, but he's not going to come in and go, you screwed up again.
Now this time I'm going to blitz you with fire.
Jonathan.
I just wanted to say that if you take what that promise makes you feel, you know, the sense of responding out of gratitude to the saving action of God, in this case for the whole cosmos, as even for our own lives, you know, what can you do? But you got to do something. You can't hear that, feel grateful, and do nothing. And a little game I play, and I'd like help in learning how to play it more graciously, because you can ask my wife how easy it is to live with me.
The lady with the golden shoes.
Yeah, is look, as you go around in your community, ask yourself, what kind of an economy would there be in this community if every consumer behaved like I do? Let me explain. I took a vow somewhere real early in the piece that I just didn't have anything to do with fast food. I just couldn't dig it from the beginning. So in the community that I go around in my little heart, and this can be a little pharisaic, so you got to watch out. But in the community of my heart, there's no fast food. There's no McDonald's, none of them, you know. I don't like shopping, so there wouldn't be a shopping mall. And I try not to go to them. I honestly try not to go to shopping malls. I like hardware stores. I like camping stores. I go to a movie about twice a year, so there'd be maybe one movie theater about 100 miles away, but I ride a bicycle quite a bit. I ride a motorcycle quite a bit. I ride a car that gets 50 miles a gallon. And I'm feeling the price of gas at those rates. So anyway, if you just extrapolate from your behavior, that's the economy you're creating. And you take a kind of a unhealthy pleasure in the fact that you're not part of the rest of it. But that's not a real comfortable place. And I think we need something more shared. And what it feels like to me is I go to a relative's house, they serve me supper on paper plates and plastic silverware. It all goes in. They, in one meal, create as much garbage as our family does in a week. What's the consequence of that? The consequence is the garbage mountain that you can make the ski resort out of in Chicago, you know, in a few years. But could the church
But you're right that can be very pharisaic, because you don't really know the motives of what might have gone into the cook and why she chose to use the paper maybe just that day.
Well,
all right, let me suggest a couple possible things.
Yes. Several
times. All right, because I think this gets to the question of what you as an individual can do and what the world needs to do and how we live in it but not of it. I just want to read two things here before we end. One is the conclusion of this article by David Rhodes, and I hope he publishes it somewhere less obscure because I think it's great. He proposes in his final section here that we can read the New Testament as a manual for facing a possible end to the world. Because early Christians surely thought that Christ would return any minute. We too are facing a possible end of the world as humans know it because of the drastic changes that must take place that may take place in the Earth's environment. Parallels between New Testament apocalyptic expectations and the crises of our own time become obvious and may require a radical response from us. In the face of a new vision of a new world before them, the early Christians did not abandon the present age, nor did they, like we, expect God to come and clean up the mess. On the contrary, they prepared for the salvation and the new age as a means to witness to the blessings of God in the presence and a means to avoid God's judgment. So he suggests we can be in a similar situation. So let's learn from them what they did. They were facing an imminent end of the world. What did they do? Number one, he says they had a deep sense of mission, illustrated by, you know, all the gospel texts about going from village to village to spread the message. You just do a little village at a time. Number two, he says the early Christians were truth tellers. They made penetrating analyses of the human condition, of the imperial situation, the dark side of human character, and they also told life-giving stories, but they told the truth about themselves, about the world. Number three, they withdrew and disassociated themselves from the behaviors and lifestyles and beliefs of the culture. Number four, they confronted the destructive powers, fearlessly challenging their idolatry and hypocrisy. And remember, early Christians had no power to change the empire, but they could confront it. Number five, they created alternative communities quite different from the culture around them. And we see that especially in the book of Acts, the descriptions of the communities, but other places as well. All the letters of the New Testament, he's talking about alternative communities right in the midst of empire. They couldn't go somewhere on an exodus. But within the culture, they could undertake a kind of exodus and simply live differently and be a witness. I don't know what number I'm on here because these are bullet six. Okay. They did prophetic acts like Jesus. In a sense, their lives were prophetic symbols. So maybe that's what you're talking about, Jonathan. You could view it like that, that you're not going to, you know, that you're simply doing an action. Of course, you're supposed to do it without people. A prophetic act would be something visible. So David Rhodes says things like healing the sick, feeding the hungry, eating with outcasts, forgiving sinners. All of these are prophetic symbols of a new age that is impinging on the present. The new age is breaking in, and you do actions that show that. Number seven, then, in all of this, they were willing to act unilaterally as far as they were able to create a new world without waiting for the leaders of the nations or the rest of the populace to lead the way or even agree with them. They were these tiny minorities. I mean, Jesus uses image of salt and leaven, little tiny amounts, but they were willing to do something very bold. I mean, sociologists will tell us the size of the early Christian communities. One guy proposes that the size of the Christian church in Corinth was all the people that are mentioned in the letter. That's like 10. That's not very many. Or in Romans, it's 26. I mean, these are tiny, tiny little churches making a huge difference because they're willing to act unilaterally, live boldly, witness, do truth-telling and mission. So I think, you know, if we can begin to see that the Bible was written at a time when people really thought they were living at the edge of an apocalyptic era dawning, and how they did it in such a hope-filled and all-embracing kind of way, that can be a witness to us. Let me just mention this book, Power Down. I didn't order it for the bookstore. What I did order for the bookstore, oh yeah, I got to tell you, I got to sell some books now. She ordered multiple copies of Boiling Point, so please lay it on your heart to consider buying this one. and my book came in huge quantities, so I'll show this video at the end about the Left Behind people and me. But Power Down is by this guy, Richard Heinberg, coming out of the secular world, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. He's been one of the leaders in the peak oil movement, so that he's featured in this Harper's article too. But let me just read from the back of this, because this is really telling. As we face the end of oil, he says there's four possible responses. The first possible response he calls last one standing. That is the path of competition, ruthless competition for the remaining resources. And that seems to be what we're doing, right?
Yep.
Fighting it out for the last resources. The second one he calls waiting for a magic elixir. That is wishful thinking, false hopes, and denial. The third one, though, the third and fourth, I think can be of interest to Christians and that we can maybe use. The third one he calls power down, the path of cooperation, conservation, and sharing, and simply deciding to reduce the size of our footprint. That is consciously powering down, using less, even though you could use more. I mean, we've got so much coal in the world, we could burn it all and have plenty, but is that what we want to do? No, we need to power down. I use the image in my book of land power in the book of Revelation as being what I think that book is about, but it's this sense of its power. It's a powerful move. It's not weak or wimpy to say, I am going to live a smaller life. And it can be a very powerful witness. So I think we need that one. And we should talk as Christians how we can do that together, what that might look like. Then the other one, I don't like his name for it, but I think this can also help us as Christians. He calls it building lifeboats. And I think that's got unfortunate connotations of the whole Garrett Hardin thing with lifeboat ethics and stuff. But he says this is the path of community solidarity and preservation, that small communities will in fact live off the grid or live differently and will model a preservation of the aspects of our culture that we most need, so that you don't have to wait for the whole culture to power down. Communities simply will decide that we can undertake this. Now, why I like these two images, especially the power down one, I was on a global warming panel with a climatologist from the University of Chicago who I had no idea was a Christian. He was, in fact, one of the writers of the international, the UN climate change panel's document. You know, you got all these big shot scientists. But he was speaking as a Presbyterian then. He said, I use the image now of fossil fuel as being like that tree in the middle of the garden, in the Genesis story of the Garden of Eden. That, you know, in that story, God places a tree right in the middle, right in front of Adam and Eve, and says, don't eat from this fruit. But it's right there. It's easy pickings. I mean, it's low-hanging fruit. All they would have to do is, you know, just... And he says, we've got to think of oil as like that now, like that tree of the knowledge of goodness and evil that's right in the middle of the garden, that we now know how harmful to us it is. And we've got to quit eating off that tree. And I thought, well, that's a really interesting image, you know, coming here from a climatologist, of how can we then use biblical images of deciding that you don't have to eat from everything in sight and you don't have to partake of all the fruit that's there. Is that a way that can help us power down? But I do think we're in a dire and urgent moment, and we've got to look for biblical images that will help us both have a strong sense of hope, but also the radical urgency of changing our way of life.
Barbara?
Lauren, I'll call on my husband. How's that? And then Jeff.
I'd like to add on to this a little bit as far along the lines of hope. When I first started looking into the issues of peak oil, I found the thinking as being pretty weak. And I still think it's, in many ways, depending on how fast it comes on us, as it brings you from bleak to very serious. But I would like to encourage you to consider next September 22nd to the 24th in Yellow Springs, Ohio, there is a peak oil and global warming conference. But ultimately what it does is they move rather rapidly into issues on how to change life. And I went to it last year, and I want to encourage Barb and I both to come to it this year.
It changed him. He was despairing when he was up at home, and he comes back really hopeful from this conference. It was great.
What was it that was hopeful? Was it steps given to you, specific steps?
Well,
was
more
it
like just being around people. Simply, you just have the sense of people who are just busy going off in a new direction. So in a lot of ways, it's like these small communities that Barb was talking about, 10 here, 22 there. There's, you know, it was like aligning with a group of people that for whom it's just, they're just getting ready in a hopeful way. Not stocking up on AK-47s and ammo, but just changing.
And, you know, how can we bring this then to our churches? How can we be this kind of visionary community that helps people in a hope-filled way realize that you don't need all this stuff for an abundant life? I mean, I do think we have to rethink issues of what is abundant life? What does the Bible tell us about fundamental things? But, yeah, the idea of hope. Okay, Jennifer, and then...
Last week, John McGrath was here, and he's the writer-producer of Affluenza and Buyer Be Fair, etc. And he gave us the website. It's www.myfootprint.org. It takes about 5 minutes. You go in there, and then you answer the questions. And then you'll find out what kind of impact you're having on oil use or energy use in the world. And as I think somebody else had said, you know, he was saying that at this rate, if everyone in the world consumed at the rate we consume, it would take 6 Earths. And so, and I think it was in the Buyer Be Fair documentary, which comes out this October. And it'll be sent by satellite another week or so, but advocate with your public broadcasting station. Ask them to run it in your community.
And then have the sense that it's a powerful response. I mean, I think I really like John Graff's stuff, this idea of powering down. You know, it's the very opposite of that Hummer ad that we saw just before we came up here. You know, the woman, it's a terrible ad. The woman whose kid gets pushed off the swing at the playground or something, so she's like, I'm going to go show you, and she goes out and buys a Hummer. So, but, you know, what if we did the very opposite? If we viewed our most powerful thing we could do, not driving around a Hummer, but... something more like lamb power, you know, something more like Jesus of disarming. And yeah, that it's there's just so many ways that Christians can respond. Thanks, Jennifer.
One thing that where I get a cold slap of reality is this notion of, you know, you have this vision of the early church as this very small minority as the salt and the yeast. But one of the nice things about being a minority is the ability to have this kind of righteousness, knowing that you're just a very small number. But the minute your message or your vision is co-opted by the majority culture, you, in some ways, you lose your ability to be effective. You know, once Rome became Christian, everything that Rome did was Christian, even though it was a lot of the same thing. But all of a sudden, oh, it's Christian, so it must be okay. And same with the civil rights movement. You know, we have this vision, this minority vision that was, you know, that all of a sudden was co-opted by the majority of America, and all of a sudden civil rights progress is essentially stopped because everybody's into civil rights and rallies that very few people can.
Yeah, it's no, and you're absolutely right. I mean, after Constantine, the church took a turn that was, in a sense, selling out. But nonetheless, still in the Gospels, we can retrieve these wonderful images. I mean, I'll just leave you with this one. Jesus talks about sowing seeds. The sower goes out and sows seeds and throws them everywhere. That's what we can all be about, is sowing seeds. And they can still be those radical seeds, even in the midst of a corrupt church, if you want to say, or a Constantinianized culture. We are the ones who are called to be the bearers of this hope. And
but when BP turns around and says, and look at us.
And Walmart, too.
And Walmart, yeah, we're green.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's we need them all. I mean, so, yeah, maybe that's the co-opted way. All right, somebody else had a hand back here, and then, no? Okay, go ahead. Salmon. Salmon.
Thinking of spiritual gifts as a piece that needs to be brought to it. It's not just the gifts listed in the New Testament, but it's also then the gifts of engineering and gifts for management and creative and technological gifts that will be part of changing how we use the resources.
Wow, the fruits of the Spirit. Wow, that's great.
I was just reading something about Thor Heyerdahl and his effort to try to get away from civilization. Yeah, and that can't be done. Somehow, you just alluded to the image from Revelation of withdrawing. And we can't do that, at least not in a simple sort of way. Somehow the movement to withdraw has to also be combined with going deeper in.
Uh-huh. All right, we need to end here. Let me just say, sorry, I know hopefully you keep the conversation going, coffee break. I promised the bookstore I would say that my book also came in and that you would get it, because they ordered a lot of copies, and I'm happy to sign it for you if you want. I'll also show for 7 minutes now, if you want, this 60 Minutes video that has, if you haven't read any of the Left Behind novels, it'll show you Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins. I highly recommend it. And then I'm on at the end with a little cameo appearance. But thank you very much, and write me notes.